What, are you guys enjoying your supper sixes?
You learn things about people when you're in supper six with them, don't you? I learned that Dara is not a prophet, as he suggested a few weeks ago when we scheduled our supper six for this afternoon after church. He suggested we do it in the park. Well, we are in the middle of Isaiah, and chapter 26, you can turn there. One of the things that is clear to me from this, looking at this chapter today, it's about the same length as the book of Jude, which we heard in the message this morning. You probably heard a lot more messages out of Jude than you have out of Isaiah 26, and one of the reasons is it's just hard to understand some of the things that Isaiah says. Now, having said that, even if we don't like fully grasp, you know, the whole unit of thought and everything that's going on there, I don't think we will, but even without that, there are just some glorious truths and some encouraging thoughts, and whether you're struggling with message to preach, you know, a couple messages to preach this coming week, or you're struggling with a surgery on Friday, or with cancer, or whatever, there is something, there's a verse here. As we read through now, there's a verse or two or three that will be an encouragement to you in whatever your situation. And if there's no trials, if there's anybody in this room who's not struggling right now, then certainly there will be something here for you as well. So we're going to read here in a second, chapter 26. It's in the middle of a four-chapter section, Isaiah from chapter 24 through chapter 27, we're in the third of four parts in that is sometimes called the little apocalypse. I don't know if I mentioned that term in the previous weeks or not. What's another name for the book of Revelation? It's apocalypse. Apocalypse is a big fancy word, which means the unveiling or the revealing or like the revelation. And there's a lot of similarities here between in Isaiah 24 through 27 with the book of Revelation, right? Remember, we were talking about the millennium, seems to be mentioned, and the binding of Satan, and the tribulation, right, and the Armageddon, and there's a lot of that. So that's the greater context. The phrase that keeps popping up throughout all four of these chapters is, in that day. So you see it, you know, again and again. And so I think as we read this, and it's tough, that keep that in mind. Kind of have that as in your head. This is in that day, in that future day of the Lord, which includes both judgment and blessing. This is, the beginning. It's the song that is going to be sung. But it's not maybe... You might expect that this is going to be all real happy, and it's all going to be like perfect. Like now we have the kingdom, and there's some things in here that kind of may catch you off guard. So here I'm trying to convince you that you want to really listen as we read this and try to understand and figure out what's going on. It is a little bit longer too, 21 verses. So let's try to figure it out. How about if we break it up into three parts? This is going to follow my outline. Here's another example. My outline doesn't agree with anybody's outline that I read. And I tell you that just to say that you may not agree with my outline, or you. That's it's just tough to figure out everything here. So who would read the first six verses? Pam, and then... who'll take 7 through 11? Becky has that. And then the next section will be the longest. From verse 12, now you got to listen real carefully here. Actually, I'll take a volunteer and then I'll listen. You want to read it? You got to read it well. From verse 12 to Isaiah 26. You know, how about if I break that into two parts? How about if you read verses 12 through 15? Okay? And then the next reader, Vicki, if you'll take 16 through chapter 27, verse 1. Bad chapter break here. The chapter break should be the beginning of verse 2. So we'll include that. Okay, so Pam, I think you're first.
In that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. God makes salvation its walls and ramparts. Open the gates that the righteous nation may enter, the nation that keeps faith. You will keep in perfect peace him whose mind is steadfast because he trusts in you. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord is the rock eternal. He humbles those who dwell on high. He lays the lofty city low. He levels it to the ground and casts it down to the dust. Feet trample it down. The feet of the oppressed, the footsteps of the poor.
The path of the righteous is level. O upright one, you make the way of the righteous smooth. Yes, Lord, walking in the way of your laws, we wait for you. Your name and renown are the desires of our hearts. My soul yearns for you in the night. In the morning, my spirit longs for you. When your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness. Though grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. Even in a land of uprightness, they go on doing evil, and regard not the majesty of the Lord. O Lord, your hand is lifted high, but they do not see it. Let them see your zeal for your people and be put to shame. Let the fire reserved for your enemies consume them.
Lord, you establish peace for us. All that we may have accomplished, you have done for us. O Lord, our God, our other lords besides you have ruled over us, but your name alone do we honor. They are dead now. They live no more. They have departed spirits, do not rise. You have punished them and brought them to ruin. You wiped off out all memory of them. You have enlarged the nation, O Lord, you have enlarged the nation. You have gained glory for yourself, you have expanded all borders of the land.
Lord, they came to you in their distress when you disciplined them. They could barely whisper a prayer. As a woman with child and about to give birth rises and cries out in her pain, so were we in your presence, O Lord. We were with child, we writhed in pain, but we gave birth to wind. We have not brought salvation to the earth. We have not given birth to people of the world. But your dead will live, their bodies will rise. You who dwell in the dust, wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. Go, my people, enter your rooms and shut the doors behind you. Hide yourselves for a little while until this wrath has passed by. See, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the earth for their sins. The earth will disclose the blood shed upon her. She will conceal her slain no longer. In that day, the Lord will punish with his sword, his fierce, great, and powerful sword, Leviathan the gliding serpent, Leviathan the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea.
Maybe just a few of your thoughts. What did you get? What's a concept or a truth that, just quickly, here, before I kind of give you a little, maybe a bigger picture on this. Anybody?
I thought that was really interesting. In the first part, we have a strong, you know, they're trusting wholly in God's protection, so let's open the gates. God just seems so different.
By the way, we have open gates in Revelation 21 of the New Jerusalem. Open gates. Yeah, that means you have safety.
I don't know exactly what all of this means in the analogy of the woman giving birth, but
oh,
however, a woman were to go all throughout labor and deliver nothing but wins, I assure you she'd be extremely disappointed and upset.
Right.
You know, and just thinking about that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's an emotion that goes along with it.
It's a very powerful picture.
Yes, it is.
There's protection in the beginning, but then also in the end, it talks about the ending of verses, you know, enter your room, shut the doors behind you, hide yourselves. The wrath is coming, and even the, we have not brought salvation here, not given birth to the world. I mean, I guess it's maybe talking about God's place, but it just seems like it's a really troubling time, and the problems really contrast with the first two verses where it seems like there's a lot of protection being kept in peace.
Yes, very good observation. I'll pass out the outline here and notes. And I entitled this chapter, and I may be wrong, and again, I don't think anybody else did, the other guys I read. And I study it and try and figure it out myself, and then I go and read others. It usually confirms, in for the most part, what my thinking is, and it sometimes expands it, sometimes it corrects it, usually in a minor way. This time I was more frustrated with what some of the guys I read, like, no, this is not right, in my opinion. But and why I tell you that is because... sometimes I'm really sure like this is right, and I think what I'm going to share with you now. A check is what other wise students of Scripture say, and so that's just sort of a warning or just a note here that maybe we have to do more work on it, but. Look at the in your notes. Did they get everybody get a set of notes that needs one? Anybody need one? Anyone want one who doesn't have one? Sometimes they're left over in the back, but people have passed it by. So, but look at the outline of this so-called little apocalypse. I don't know if that's a good name for it, but there's something interesting and unique about these four chapters, as I mentioned. And here's how I have entitled the four. Chapter 24 is the judgment of the earth. Not much debate about that. That's that, the cataclysmic language of God ripping the earth apart. And then there is the establishment of the kingdom. That's the flip side. 24 and 25, everybody agrees, are closely related. And it's almost two sides of the coin, where you have God destroys it, the earth, in order to restore it, in order to rebuild it. But then, this one here is like, what's going on? There's a song, right? At the beginning it says, in that day, they will sing, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. So, it's in a future time, they're singing a song. Right here I get mixed up with all these. Okay, we got Isaiah, who's here. And then there's us, who's here. All of my stick figures are going to look alike. How do I distinguish my stick figures? And then there's in that day. Now there's a question: is in that day, is chapter 26 happening between Isaiah and us, or is it happening? I think it's happening down here. So in that day, they're going to sing a song. Now they're singing a song about what already happened, right? So we got a lot of different time references going on here, and that's one of the reasons for the confusion. But in my opinion, The chapter as a whole is talking primarily about judgment. God's judgment, and I say all peoples, it's actually bigger than that. In that last verse, the first verse of chapter 27, is the killing of Leviathan. What is that? I don't think you don't have to try to answer the question right now. I think if you just jump in and like read the verse, I think you'll think it's one thing. But if you are reading it in the context, I think you'll understand that Isaiah's using it as a symbol. So we'll get there. If I don't dilly-dally too much along the way. And then the next week, we're going to wrap up this section here on, and I've entitled it, The Restoration of Israel, and I think that's a reasonable. So the most difficult of the four, I think, is this week here. But I think we see the judgment of all peoples. Now, when you try to put this in a timeline, because we try to do this, right? Especially if you've kind of grown up in a Bible church, or especially in a church that has our view of eschatology, this big awful word that we use called dispensationalism, which I hate the word. I believe it's just a biblical understanding of what God teaches about the future. And one of its distinguishing features is that it really sees a lot of pieces and parts in the future. You could go to another church and they don't see any pieces and parts of the of God. They just see Jesus comes back and he judges everybody, and then there's the eternal state. That's the Reformed view, the amillennial view, more or less. I mean, that's pretty much as detailed as it gets. Whereas if you're dispensational, then you're seeing, I mean, every little thing you want to say, well, this is here and this is, so you've got a rapture. You have two second comings, right? You've got, you know, he comes back and he takes the church, and then he comes back in order to defend Israel. That's what he's doing. And then he's establishing not the eternal state, but an earthly kingdom, and it lasts for 1,000 years. And of course it gets a lot more complicated than that. But so if you're from that tradition, and I think most of us are, then you read this chapter and you're trying to figure out, like, okay, so is this talking about, and John, you're hitting on this, like at the beginning of the chapter it says they're rejoicing, hey, we've been saved, and then at the end of the chapter they're like, wait a second, you guys better go hide because God's going to judge the bad people. So which is it? Let me try to, I'm going to make a case. This is not the most important thing, but just to try to, if you look at verse 10, it says, in a land, though grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. Even in a land of uprightness, they go on doing evil and regard not the majesty of the Lord. What is this referring to? Is this talking about Isaiah's day, 700 BC? I can't see how it is.
I think it goes back to that millennial time where the land is being ruled by the Lord.
That's what I think too. Now, I don't know that Isaiah could have said it. I mean, he didn't know the word millennium because there was no revelation, as I told you before, about of a thousand. But that's kind of what I came to, and I was resistant to it, not because I don't fully embrace that understanding from Scripture. I do, but just because it seems like a really developed and advanced view to see in Isaiah.
Just goes with the larger context.
Yeah, that's kind of where I've come to. Is that what we have here? And I don't know that it's gonna fall out exactly the way that we may want it to. But we have salvation in the beginning, and that's related to last chapter, which is the establishment of the kingdom. So God has set up His kingdom on earth, but it's not perfect. Not because God's not perfect, but because there are sinners in it. Then the question is, well, how do sinners get into the kingdom? Isaiah doesn't answer that. So, in a way, if we're just teaching this passage, I don't know that I need to feel like I go any. Isaiah just realizes that even in that day, there's going to be some mixture. Do you remember? This is just going to throw more confusion, but why not? Remember the parable? It just comes on. The parable that Jesus tells of the wedding banquet, and he sends out, and by the way, some of these things will make more sense after now that you study Isaiah. Sends out and invites these people to come, and no, we're not going to come, and other people to come. And Well, then some people come, and you're like, okay, this makes sense, it's easy. And then, I don't even know where this is in the Bible, so Matthew 22 maybe. And where there's a guy there without wedding clothes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matthew 22. The king came in to see his guests. He noticed a man there who was not wearing wedding clothes. Friend, he asked, how did you get in here without wedding clothes? The man was speechless. Then the king told the attendants, tie him hand and foot, throw him outside into the darkness, or there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Like, what is going on? I mean, we're not studying that. If you got an answer, you can come tell me after. But I'm using that as an illustration right now to say maybe there's some other support for mixture in the earthly kingdom. And then the best support, of course, comes from Revelation 20. Jesus establishes a kingdom for 1,000 years, at the end of which there's a rebellion led by... No, I didn't look at what I was preparing, that's what I'm going through right now. But who's it led by? Satan. It says, I don't know if it said Satan. And then it says in verse 10, and the devil. Satan is released from prison and he goes out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth. That means there's people all over the earth who are going to join with him. And there it's not a small number. They're like the sand on the seashore. So there's a huge amount of people who march across the earth. They surround the camp of God's people, the city he loves. You know, I think city there, is he talking about chapter 26, verse 1? We have a strong city. They march against God's city, but fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur. That's the closest connection here to understand what's going on. But let's just go back and take it section of time. I just wrote the outline on the board too to have it handy behind me. But the first part is a song. In fact, maybe the whole thing's a song, or I'm not sure exactly where the song ends. But at least through verse 6, everybody would agree on that, I think. The interesting thing here too, if it is the time of God has saved them and they have a strong city, why do they say verses 3 and 4? Why are they saying in their song, trust in the Lord? It's like they're encouraging each other. It's like even in that day, there's a need to, you know, to encourage one another. And I don't know if that's hinting at the presence of evil, or I don't know. Some of the questions it's not so critical for me to answer. Because I know what the application doesn't change. Let's see, I mean, the reality is if they're trusting God then, if they're encouraging one another, then when Jesus is king in Jerusalem, as it's all this, and with a wedding banquet going on, as described in the last chapter, then all the more now. Encourage one another, brethren, daily with these words. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord is the rock eternal. There is nothing else. Then or now, that is as secure as the Lord. Everything else, by comparison, is shifting sand. Right? I mean, medical diagnoses. I mean, one day it's this, it may not be that way. Expectations. Family. And then, is everybody familiar with verse 3? Or I don't know. I've heard it before I was studying Isaiah, but and so I assume maybe you have too, or maybe you haven't, but that's a good verse. That's one to memorize. What's the New Testament counterpart, by the way? Like, where did Paul Right? I mean, when Paul wrote in Philippians 4, 6 and 7, now how does it go? Is that saying something very similar here? You keep your mind on God, and He will give you. You know, what does it say He will give you? What is your translation say? The first phrase of three. You will keep in what?
Perfect.
Does anybody differ on that? They all say the same.
Completely.
It says, you will keep in shalom, shalom. And in Hebrew, when it repeats the word, you know, that's for, you know, magnification. Sometimes it talks about an army coming and attacking, and the largest number they have in Hebrew is 1,000. So the army was composed of 1,000. Well, He will keep in shalom, shalom. In perfect peace is a great translation. But the word peace, shalom, right, which is a very familiar word today to us, it does mean peace, but it also means wholeness or completeness, or, you know. So it really is, you know, to have it's perfect because it's whole, because it's not lacking anything. So the Lord will keep in peace him whose mind is steadfast, or dependent on the Lord, is the idea. And then in verses 5 and 6, there's a contrast between the proud in Isaiah's day, and he was living in the midst of as much wickedness and corruption as we have today, in my estimation. And I can't be sure, but it just seemed, when I just study about what life was like in 700 BC, and I've done a lot of it actually, I don't think, you know, we're like way, way better in our wickedness. I think they were pretty wicked. Mm-hmm. So in Isaiah's day, you have these proud, rich, oppressive people. And then you have the poor and the needy. Remember we talked about the poor and the needy last week? Well, it's the same, they show up again here in verse 6. The poor and the needy, same words. But this is flipped around. So now the poor and the needy are walking on the dust of that once great city. And the comparison here, we've talked about the city. I don't know if you remember that from last two chapters as well. The city is a symbol of all that is against God, going back to Babel. And this is, so we have this God-defying city in contrast to the city of God, in which salvation is the defense. The walls and the ramparts are salvation. And you have the contrast between that proud city now is the dust upon which the poor and the needy walk. So a total reversal of the way things are right now. That's the first section, verses 1 through 6. The second section, I want to do this one the most quickly. I think it's maybe the easiest of the part of the chapter. Maybe just pull out here in verse 8. Your name and renown are the desires, are the desire of our hearts. I think that really captures well the essence of true faith, of a believer. You know, there's a contrast in these verses between those who are trusting the Lord and those who are not, right? The outline here, this is the differing responses of the peoples. And the response of the righteous is that they seek God's name and renown. I don't like the sort of present popular definition of a Christian as someone who has assent you know, some intellectual assent to, yeah, I think that happened. I think that, you know, he lived or he died, or a more biblical definition of the righteous, those who are saved here, in contrast to those who aren't, are those who, the desire of their hearts is God's name and his renown. Right? You understand? Name is all that who God is, his character, his reputation. That's what they long for. They long for it in the morning. They long for it in the night, verse 9. In contrast to the wicked. And the wicked, and we already looked at verse 10, but just to see here in this context, the wicked can be living in the kingdom. They can see King Jesus in Jerusalem. And they go on doing evil. And they don't care about the Lord. The problem isn't you know, that, well, I just need more to believe. Right? I just need to see more. You know, you're asking me to, well, in that day, they're gonna have it all there. And it's because of the heart. Doesn't want. The heart rejects. The heart loves its wickedness more than God's righteousness. In verse 11, there's the specter of punishment. They don't even see it. They're not looking for it. And so Isaiah says, or the song that says, may they be punished. I think that is on the way here in verses 20 and 21. Now, I'm taking as one section, verse 12 through 27:1. That's a lot of verses, but I think the main idea here is God's greatness over all else. And there's some expected comparisons, like you expect God to be greater than the wicked. But there's also the comparison with the remnant, with the believers. We say with us, by application. So the first verses, look at 12 through 15. In 12 through 15, you have, again, the believers, the righteous here, acknowledging God's greatness. And these are good verses here too, especially verse 12. Look at verse 12. Lord, you established peace for us. All that we have accomplished, you have done for us. Is that true? Can you say that in your life now? Or is it because of your abilities? The answer of faith, the answer of a faithful man or woman is to recognize that everything good comes from God. What New Testament, anybody think of a New Testament verse or two that says something similar?
Every good and perfect gift comes down.
Good. What else?
There's none good but God.
What's that?
There's none good but God.
I was thinking of, and I don't remember the reference here, but it's in Corinthians. What do you have that you have not received? All that we have accomplished, you have done for us. If there's anything good, it's from God. And they say in verses 13 and 14, Lord, by comparison, we've had a lot of other rulers. And I'm not sure if they're talking about the local Judean kings here. I don't think so. I think they're probably talking about, we've had the Assyrians ruling over us, and we paid a heavy tribute. We've had, you know, we used to be slaves in Egypt, and all of these guys, and they were great. But what? In verse 14, they're dead. And they're gone. And you wiped out all memory of them. I read one of the books I read, and this might resonate more with Robert, possibly. I didn't put this quote in the notes because I thought it might not mean so much to some of you, but the illustration was given when it says you wiped out all memory of the former rulers, that we don't even know the name of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And that's something scholars, and I'm really into that kind of thing. Like, who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? I know it wasn't Ramses II, by the way. So if you're watching The Prince of Egypt, you need to just dub that part out when you're showing it to your kids or grandkids. But we don't know. I mean, the memory, the record, it's... But God, right? Who is it, verse 15, who has done this? Who enlarged the nation? So, you know, here I'll just jump out here. Some people want to make this chapter not about the millennium, like I'm suggesting, but about like Isaiah's time. And they say it was Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a king in most of Isaiah's rule. Hezekiah made the nation. You know, he was the one. I don't think that's what this is talking about. This is talking in a context of when God gained glory for himself. I don't think that was true in 700 BC. But they're going to recognize, verses 12 through 15, they recognize, God, you've done all this. Now, contrast with the weakness of everyone else. And that's verses 16 through 18. And it's the weakness of, verse 16 is probably the toughest one in the chapter, partly because it suddenly we got a they in there. Like, who are they? Who are we talking about here? But without getting into it, whoever it is, they are not comparable to God. They are weak. They can barely even, depend, I don't know how your translation goes a few different ways, barely whisper a prayer, barely utter. I mean, they're just weak. And then, verse 17, now it shifts to we. This is clear. Again, I think it's still this righteous remnant. It's still Isaiah and those who are like him. Well, I mean, who are projecting forward to the kingdom time. And they're saying, even our best efforts were failures, right? This picture here of a woman with child. I work with different translations at home, and I brought one. And I, does anyone have ESV or NAS? What does the end of verse 17 say?
I have
the NIV. No, not the NIV. Anybody? Yeah, what does the end of 17 say in NAS?
She writhed and cried out in her labor pains. Thus were we before thee, O Lord.
Thus were we before thee. Is that what I was thinking of?
ESV says, so we were because of you.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. Because of... That's probably the best translation there. It's like God brought the trial about. And... in verse 18, I think it's crystal. The thought is crystallized here in the second half of verse 18. We have not brought salvation to the earth. What was that? Israel, the chosen people of God. God didn't put them on this earth. God didn't choose Abraham and say, "I'm going to make all these," so that you can be a bucket, as it were. Right? I want you to be a channel. You're supposed to bring the message of salvation to the nations, to be a light to the nations. Isaiah, we'll use that phrase later in the book. But they failed. The Israelites did not bring salvation to the earth. They went through all the motions of labor, but there was no fruit. There was no birth. We have not given birth. That's interesting. Comparison here. Isaiah likes to do this and other writers too, but in verse 18, we have not given birth to people of the world. But in 19, the earth is going to give birth. Now we're changing the thought a little bit here. We're in a new section. Verses 19 through 21 is now speaking about, in my opinion, the resurrection. of dead people, of course, all resurrection, right? But it's in 19, it's talking about the resurrection of the righteous, I think. God is going to raise dead from the dust of the earth. And the earth is going to give birth, as it were, to the dead. Does this, I don't know if this strikes you as interesting or not. It might not. It wasn't on my radar until recently. But a lot of scholars think that the people in the Old Testament didn't believe in resurrection. Or they didn't have the hope of a physical, bodily resurrection. They say the earliest mention is in Daniel 12, which they date, they don't believe Daniel wrote it in 600 BC. They say it was written by some imposter in 150 BC. That's Daniel 12, where it says, he'll raise up some to everlasting life and some to everlasting death. This verse is a real big problem for them. Can you see? Because this verse, written by Isaiah, not in 2 Isaiah, we talked about, right? They say chapters 40 was written by some later guy pretending to be Isaiah. But this is even in the part they say is the earlier one, 700 BC. So I'm not going very far with that, but just to say here, we have a very clear explanation of individual resurrection from the dead. I think that everybody knew it all along. It just didn't necessarily come up in Deuteronomy or something, you know. But here, what's the point? What the contrast in verse 19, God is going to raise the dead, his dead, right, speaking to God, but your dead God will live. In contrast to verse 14, right? Our old rulers, they're dead. They're never going to rise again. But God will raise up the righteous. Those who dwell in the dust are going to shout for joy. Right? That's not people who are raised up to be judged in this verse. So we go to the New Testament passage and try to say, okay, where do we connect this? I think in the context here, it's talking about the great white throne judgment at the end, near the end of Revelation 20. End of millennium.
Though the verbiage is very similar to 1 Thessalonians 4:16.
Right. And there's a sense in, I mean, the righteous are raised. Right. Back up just a second. You understand that when Jesus comes, he could come at any time to take his church to heaven. Those who are in his church who have already died and buried in the ground will be, their bodies will be raised up, and they will meet, they will go first, right? We will join them. I think Paul is using this language here, but he's talking about, maybe say it this way. He's kind of dividing that up, event into a couple of different events. And so then in I think we've mentioned 20 already. 21, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the earth for their sins. I mean, again, you could take this as being end of tribulation, when God judges all the nations who are fighting against his people, or, as I believe is probably better here, the end of the millennium. What I read the end of Revelation 20, where there's this great rebellion again against God, and he punishes the people of the earth, And then the earth will disclose the blood shed upon her. So then there's going to be the unrighteous are raised, I believe, for judgment. And that fits too. And you know, my eschatology is weak. My knowledge of Revelation is weak too. You know that without me telling you. But I think that fits. With, and I didn't like it in study. I spent my time in Isaiah. But that I think that that fits with the end of Revelation 20. All I can do is read it. Where then I saw a great white throne. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. And the dead were judged according to what they had done. The sea gave up the dead that were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead that were in it. And each person was judged according to what he was done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. That fits to me. And it also fits with the last verse here, wrapping up. Last couple, the beginning, the first verse of chapter 27, kind of hinted at this already here. What is this? The Lord will punish with his sword. And it gives three descriptive words for the sword. And then it describes the enemy with three descriptive terms also. Excuse me. Leviathan. Leviathan. The fleeing Leviathan and the coiling Leviathan and the monster or the dragon. It's clearly not a crocodile or a dinosaur that's talking, right? I mean, how anticlimactic would that be if this is just some big beast? No. What some think is this is a symbol for evil. I agree. I think we can go a little bit further. What's the word here that's used for the word serpent? Right? It's the same word in Genesis 3. Now, that doesn't prove anything by itself, but it's certainly suggestive. And in the context of this being the ultimate judgment on the earth and on the people and on the leader, on the one who has, from the beginning, been leading men against God in rebellion, to me it just really makes sense that we're talking here about the judgment of Satan. And I won't push this too much, but I'll throw this out as just the thought. You know, in Revelation, there's the evil trinity, as it were. I mean, there's not, it's not like the Lord, there's three persons in one, but there's, actually, I don't know exactly how it works, but you have the beast, the false prophet, and Satan, get that right, in like Revelation 16, 17, 18. And here you have three, you know, it's Leviathan and Leviathan and the dragon. And I don't know, to me that's curious as well. And I'll close with this thought. The next chapter, which we look at next week, I know sometimes we look at a chapter and we break it up, we don't see the connection, but In the next chapter, it's talking about the blessing. It's talking about the restoration of Israel, God's, and that makes good sense to me in light of the fact that Satan has been destroyed. So, any final thoughts or questions? That was tough. I hope you got something out of it.
Is there any significance to
there could be a few things. The sea is synonymous in the Old Testament with the the Israelites are afraid of it. I mean, the sea is a great unknown and therefore an evil, a fearful thing. In Revelation 21, it says, in heaven, there will be no more sea. And there seems to be a connection there with that's now vanquished. You also have right, the beast coming out of the sea in Revelation. I don't know that I can say much more. And nobody's talking. When I like, you know, the books I read, and I'm reading good commentaries and books by conservative, and they're not saying this for the most part. I found one, and I put the quote in your handout that I even identified as Satan. They just want to say it's a great moral evil, or it's chaos, or I think it is that and more. Yeah.
I've heard it explained that the sea is symbolic of the great number of humanity. Kind of a general reference to humanity, and in Revelation, when the beast comes out of the sea, like a man stands apart from the rest of the people. He comes out of the people, energized by Satan. So, you know, that looking at the sea as just being massive humanity.
Yeah, could be. I'm not familiar with that, but could well be.
The thought that hits me is that when Paul was in Arabia all this time, and God was basically, you know, taking him back through the scriptures, he had mastered the scriptures by that point,
right.
The Old Testament. He had mastered it.
Yep.
But what he had to do is he had to take him through and reinterpret that. And I always wondered, why did it take so much time? And I think, you know, going through Isaiah, you know, well, I mean, seriously, you know, because he had to say that, you know, you have to walk through with a fresh set of eyes,
right?
Because there are other purposes, and the Gospels are full of Jesus reinterpreting what they thought they understood the interpretation of the passage to be,
right.
And him showing no, it had so much more was right there before your eyes. That's why you could ever see but not see.
Yes, and I'll just say again too, my goal in this teaching is not that we get our system all figured out, but that we are wrestling with Isaiah, and so that in the rest of your life and your week, and you know that you're probably more naturally drawn to the New Testament anyway, that you'll understand Isaiah better, or you'll understand that better because of the time spent on Isaiah. So if I was a better teacher and or had more time, then I could like try to put it all together for you, but I'm doing the best I can right now. So let's pray. Father, thank you for this word of encouragement. And is that we can't answer all the questions, and I don't know that we need to. We do need to trust you. We do need to see in this passage that you are sovereign over Leviathan. I mean, whatever that is, the greatest, your greatest enemy is but a little toy soldier against you. And so we entrust our lives to you. We entrust our families, our health, our jobs, our career decisions. You're worthy of these things. You're worthy of much more. And we say, too, that we desire that your name and your renown be exalted above all else. Even here right now, we know it's going to be done perfectly only in heaven. But we seek that now through our lives in little tiny ways, but do that through us and for us, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.